Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Today, my colleague and co-host Sam Wong wasn't able to join us. The term free enterprise is a term that we often hear in American politics. Often in recent decades, conservative politicians and activists have used the term free enterprise to explain what their agenda is about relative to what the Democratic agenda is. But many Democrats have also made it clear that they too support this idea of free enterprise. The idea is often ambiguous. It's used more as a political slogan than a political theory, but it's one of the most common parts of our popular lexicon. But we don't really know much about where this came from, what the idea has meant in different periods, and what the stakes are and how we define it. So today we have with us Lawrence Glickman, who is the Stephen and Evelyn Millman Professor of American Studies at Cornell University. Glickman is the author of numerous books, including Buying Power, A History of Consumer Activism in America. He writes for many publications, including the Boston Review, Dissent, other newspapers, and is also very popular on Twitter with his threads about what's going on in politics today in historical perspective. Today, we're going to discuss his new book, Free Enterprise and American History, which has just come out with Yale University Press and has been receiving favorable reviews in a number of places, including the Wall Street Journal. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Julian. It's great to be here.
So this is an entire book about the idea, the rhetoric, the concept of free enterprise in American politics. Where does the term originate from?
Well, that's a great question. The first use I found of the term is from President Andrew Jackson in 1832, but very quickly thereafter, it was employed widely in a number of different contexts, especially by abolitionists who contrasted what they called free enterprise with slave enterprises, that is, businesses that were dependent on free labor, wage labor, rather than slave labor.
And free enterprise as opposed to free markets. Those are two different terms often used together, but are they different? Do they have different histories? Do they have different meanings?
Yeah, that's another great question. When I began my project, I kind of thought they were synonymous because, as you suggested, that's how they're often thought about today. But advocates of free enterprise in the 20th century, especially the period between the 30s and the 70s, which is really the heart of my book, made a point of distinguishing between free enterprise and free markets. And I think their idea was that free enterprise was a far more encompassing idea, more political, more social, maybe even more moral than the kind of purely economistic idea of free markets.
And what do you mean by more moral?
Well, I think they saw free enterprise as a kind of encompassing system of not just government, but of morality and of liberty and freedom. And so they took free enterprise to be an entire worldview.
And this was a term before the 1930s, where we're going to turn in a second, the New Deal and the expansion of government. Just so people understand, this is a term you'd find, I guess, in newspapers or from politicians. It was a common term, free enterprise.
Yes, it was. In the 19th century, one of the points I make in my book, in addition to the abolitionist use of the term, it very frequently was referred to as an attribute, as in a phrase like the spirit of free enterprise. How are we going to unleash the spirit of free enterprise? So it was thought about as a characteristic that individuals had and that there were ways in which society could unleash it and promote it. And so in the 19th century, free enterprise was really a subset of the broader free labor ideology, the idea that America was should be thought of as a free labor society.
And then we hit the 1930s, a key part of the book, and This is the New Deal that a set of policies put into place during the Great Depression. Franklin Roosevelt is the president. And you argue that this is a period where we really see the concept of free enterprise redefined and used in particular ways. What happens?
Yeah, that's really the heart of my book, is that I actually think free enterprise had been redefined slightly before the New Deal happened in the 1920s, is when we really get what I think most of us would consider to be a modern conception of free enterprise, which is, rather than speaking about it as an individual attribute, using it as a synonymous with the idea of the business firm and the kind of broader system in which America was built upon business firms, corporations, entrepreneurs, and so forth. But when the New Deal happened, this free enterprise, relatively new free enterprise discourse, really found its place as an oppositional ideology, and that's when it really grew. It's interesting because people who promoted free enterprise in opposition to the New Deal always talked about it as an American tradition. And the point that I try to make in my book is that it was an invented tradition, as historians like to say. In other words, it didn't really exist in the form that they talked about it in the American Revolution, in the 19th century, even in the earlier 20th century. It was really invented relatively recently, but they deployed it as an American tradition, in opposition to what they saw as the newfangled, utopian, dangerous ideas associated with the New Deal.
And invented traditions, as historians write about them, are often, they're myths, but they are myths that are used to create a sense of community or commonality among different groups. Is that part of what happens during the 1930s and 40s?
Yes, very much so. I think one of the things that I try to argue is that free enterprise, it certainly is an important vector of modern conservatism. But in the 1930s, even in the 1940s, the term conservatism didn't really have the weight it has today. For a lot of people upset about the New Deal, they were mostly upset because they thought that Franklin Roosevelt and his colleagues had perverted liberalism. They saw themselves as, in many cases, as liberals. And one of the things that they tried to do was to find a language that would allow those who opposed the New Deal to feel like they were a unified opposition. They couldn't really do that with liberalism anymore, since Roosevelt successfully kind of converted that term to the modern sense that we have today of you know, kind of progressive New Deal liberalism. But one of the things they were able to do was use the idea of free enterprise as an oppositional ideology to the New Deal. And so much of what it stood for was seen in opposition to that new force in society, the New Deal.
And one of the things I really like about your book and your other work is that you're a generation of intellectual historians who studies ideas and language, but you really put them in a very vivid institutional, political, organizational context. You see how these ideas are used and deployed and where they come from. And I think that's certainly true of this book. It's not high intellectual history removed from the people using the ideas. And in terms of this part of your story, you're talking about how it's changing and how it's being used, but who is actually promoting and circulating this free enterprise idea?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's really a pretty broad group of people. I call them, following the terminology of the time, the apostles of free enterprise. And by and large, you're absolutely right. These were, for the most part, not people we would today think of as intellectuals. They were business leaders, they were lobbyists, they were ministers, they were politicians, they were pundits, what we would today call opinion columnists. But by and large, they saw themselves as promoting and popularizing ideas. And one of the things my dissertation advisor, Larry Levine, used to say is that cultural historians study the intellectual history of people that intellectual historians aren't interested in because they're not canonical thinkers. And so most of the people that I'm writing about were, you know, we might think of them as business propagandists or lobbyists or highly ideological columnists or ministers and so forth. But I think it's really important to study that kind of sector of society because they were very influential in shaping popular thought in a way that sometimes the high intellectual thinkers were not.
And do ideas in that realm, is it the case that ideas will tend to be fuzzier or more ambiguous, or there's a lot of hypocrisy in the use of it? Meaning, if you're studying the high intellectual thinkers, academics or writers, they're going to be more precise in how they use an idea and spell out what it means. Whereas the people you're talking about, they're much more, they're going to be looser because ultimately there's an element of this being a political act. Is that true or?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, I think so much of what they knew what they didn't like, which is the New Deal. And by the way, when I talk about the New Deal, one of the points I try to make, I think I say in the book, that they contested a New Deal in their imagination. In other words, what we know about the New Deal is that it was very messy, very hard to generalize about, having different ideological impulses. But their depiction of the New Deal was extremely unitary and extremely monolithic and extremely powerful. So they knew what they opposed. They weren't as sure about what the positive definition of this idea of free enterprise was exactly. And a lot of my book is about the search, which they eventually abandoned, to find such a definition.
And the Cold War is obviously another backdrop in terms of how this was used as a term which didn't always have necessarily a clear positive meaning, but it was an alternative to, in this case, communism.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I think, you know, my view of this is that although the Cold War context is absolutely crucial, that free enterprise ideology was far more concerned with internal subversion than it was with, say, a possible Soviet or communist takeover of the United States. They really trained their target much more on New Deal liberalism than they did on Soviet communism or even American communism. And they did that because they were really pioneers of ideas that are so familiar to us today, apocalyptic thinking, binary thinking, and especially the idea of a slippery slope.
And that, I mean, that fits with my colleague here, Kevin Cruz, and his work on religion in this period. It seems that there's more interest now in understanding some of the rhetoric we've often associated with Cold War politics, but really seeing the domestic political objectives more clearly in terms of why this was being used and where it was coming from. I mean, is that a changing interest among historians?
I think so. I think that the, you know, kind of, it's a long-term process, but I think what the Cold War means has really expanded into looking much more at American internal political culture. And I've been really surprised at the way in which what in 1949 began to be called the welfare state was talked about as kind of the first step on the road to totalitarianism. And so the idea was that it almost didn't matter whether you called it a New Deal, whether you called it liberalism, whether you called it planning or collectivism. People like Herbert Hoover, the president before Roosevelt, and other free enterprisers, you know, explicitly said this. They said it doesn't really matter whether you call it liberalism or socialism or communism, because it's all going to end up in the same place anyway. And in some ways, they believe that the American meliorist welfare state was more dangerous because, unlike, say, Britain, where there was a socialist party, or France, in the United States, the Democratic Party, you know, claimed to be non-socialist. Roosevelt said he wasn't a socialist, he was a capitalist. And so they always worried about, you know, the idea of what they called the wolf in sheep's clothing or the Trojan horse, other metaphors like this.
And that was a central part of Ronald Reagan's rhetoric about healthcare He puts out that record in 19, I can't remember if it was 61.
61, yeah.
61, yeah. About the danger this proposed Medicare would have. And that's the argument. That's the opening door, healthcare, always to socialism and to communism. So it's interesting.
Exactly.
And you start one other argument, a question about this period. How powerful is this rhetoric within Republican politics? Because the other idea that a lot of historians wrote about for a long time was in the 1940s and 50s and even the early 60s, a lot of the Republican Party shifted toward the New Deal. And Dwight Eisenhower is always the classic example. And there's a famous quote where he essentially acknowledges he won't get rid of Social Security, that that's now part of the landscape. But my read of your book is you're really emphasizing the conservatism of Republican politics in this period. And have we kind of gone overboard in saying this consensus emerged, or is that still true?
Yeah, that is really one of the things I want to do in my book is take another look at moderate Republicanism. I should say, however, that one of the things about free enterprise discourse in this period is that it was not just for Republicans. A lot of Southern white Democrats adopted the language of free enterprise, and they're a very important part of my story as well. But in response to your question about the Republican Party, you know, one of the things that was often said is that from Alf Landon in 1936 through Wilkie and Dewey and Eisenhower is that the Republicans kept nominating people who were sort of what we would call today rhinos, Republicans in name only, and were not true believers. But what I found is that the language of free enterprise, because it was so binary, really minimized the opposition between moderate and more conservative Republicans. And one of the things that I try to show is that in presidential campaigns, in things like political platforms, you find that so much of what shaped Republican debating tactics and political talking points was the opposition between the free enterprise, which they supported, and the New Deal vision of the Democrats. And you know, one of the points that I try to make in my book is that the quote from Eisenhower that you referred to is often talked about. And I try to make a few points about that. One is that Eisenhower didn't say that publicly. He wrote it in a letter to his brother Edgar, who was his most conservative sibling. And, you know, my view about Eisenhower is that he was a pragmatist who recognized that it would be political suicide for him to try to overturn the New Deal. But I don't think he ever really gave up the language of free enterprise and speaking about the dangers of the potential dangers of an expanded welfare state and so forth. So his acceptance of the New Deal, I think, was much more pragmatic than ideological. And I find that with a lot of moderate Republicans on that axis, on the free enterprise axis, there's really very little that separates, say, a Dwight Eisenhower from a Robert Taft.
And you can, in addition, back to the Southern Democrats you mentioned, this inconsistency, the fact that his rhetoric is painfully apparent in that region, given it's a region that depended on military spending to rebuild itself after World War II. It depended on agricultural subsidies. Yet the Southern Democrats, who were very conservative on many issues politically, were deploying the same rhetoric. So you can kind of see it in that way as well in that region.
Yeah.
So the other thing I want to move on to is, so you also argue, though, that those in the New Deal coalition don't give up the term either, and including organized labor, and they try to find ways to claim free enterprise on their own terms. How does that work?
Yeah, well, one of the points I try to make in my book is that I think we have taken free enterprise for granted. We all kind of think we know what it means. And one of the things I found among other historians who studied free enterprise, who made my work possible because they've done brilliant investigations of it. But the one area where I find that I wanted to know more was in their kind of acceptance that free enterprise was something we all knew what it was. And what I found is that, I think it's an inherently vague term and that its meaning has been far more contested than we realize. And one element of that is that from Franklin Roosevelt through Martin Luther King, through Walter Reuther, the labor leader, and many, many others, that they were unwilling to cede free enterprise to conservatives. They did not believe it was an inherently conservative term. They thought that free enterprise was consistent with the kind of mixed government that they were promoting. And they tried to use free enterprise rhetoric in the interest of progressive vision. You really see this in the civil rights movement, but you also see it in the labor movement.
Do you think that liberals ultimately were overwhelmed by conservative efforts to use the term? Was this, in the end, a story about conservatives ultimately doing it more effectively, or is that too ignoring some of the successes of liberal politics in keeping their own hold on this idea?
No, I think it's definitely the former. I think conservatives won the battle to claim free enterprise, just as they've won the battle to claim freedom. This is something that Eric Foner wrote a book, The Story of American Freedom, in the late 1990s, and that was one of the points he tried to make in that book. And I see a very similar trajectory with free enterprise. So I think those moments that I try to recapture were important, but I think it's really hard to look at our political system, our political divide, and just sort of the common sense that Americans have about politics and not say that the conservative instantiation of free enterprise didn't win the day. Not to say that it won't last into the future, but I would say that if we're looking back right now, that's the judgment that we'd have to make.
And the Lewis Powell memo, this is early in your book, which is a memo a lot of historians have written about now and are interested in, but I don't think a lot of the public still has this on their radar. What was it and why was it important to highlight in the book?
Yeah, I chose to begin with it. In some ways, it's really the end of my story, not the beginning, because Lewis Powell, who was a powerful corporate lawyer in Richmond, Virginia, about to be appointed to the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon, wrote this memo in 1971 on behalf of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And the reason why I began with it is because I think that the Powell memo, as it became to be known, was really a culmination of the kind of anti-New Deal free enterprise discourse that I trace in my book. What's really interesting about it is that, I mean, there are many interesting components of the Powell memo, but my interpretation of it really differs from a lot of the way, not so much historians, I think other historians like Ben Waterhouse have said something similar to me, but many commentators, especially journalists, talk about the Powell memo as this massive turning point, the beginnings of modern conservatism, because of some of the things he said in that memo about the need for business to go on the offensive, the kind of self-pitying idea that he had that the businessman was, quote, the forgotten man, and that business was in the doghouse. This sort of language, which we're all familiar with today, it's a language that Trump uses all the time. A lot of people attribute it to the Powell memo of 1971. But the point that I try to make in my book is that actually Powell wasn't really saying anything different than the Chamber of Commerce said in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, and many other politicians mimicked and echoed as well.
And so you're really taking this memo that some have treated as a launching point for modern politics or conservative politics, but giving us a long multi-decade history of where this really came from.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's a lot like, one of the points I try to make is that I think Powell temperamentally was really quite similar to Dwight Eisenhower. Mm-hmm. Both of them saw themselves as moderates. You know, Powell, of course, was not a Republican at all. He was a Democrat because he was a white Southerner, but did not see himself as an ideological radical, which is how a lot of journalistic commentators talk about him, you know, this radical conservative on the warpath. But I think the difference between, you know, the 1950s when Eisenhower wrote that letter to his brother Edgar, which I think is 1955, and 1971 is that 1971, as you well know, the New Deal order was beginning to crack. And so my view is that it wasn't the diagnosis that was any different, but what was different was that opponents of the New Deal had increasing strength, and there was really the beginning of a corporate counteroffensive, and which involved the attack on organized labor, the attack on the welfare state, and so forth. These things were part of free enterprise discourse when it was kind of the minority opposition to the New Deal. But beginning around the time when Powell's memo was publicized in the 1970s, because he wrote it as a confidential memo, it only came out publicly a year later, and that was around the time when, you know, a lot of historians kind of consider to be the beginning of the breakup of the New Deal order.
And in our remaining time, what led you to write this book now? And obviously, you've been working on it for several years, so it didn't start in our exact moment. But what drove you to this topic, and why now?
Yeah, well, I was interested in how this kind of ubiquitous language of free enterprise emerged. In fact, the very first day of teaching at the University of South Carolina, which was my first job, this was in the early to mid 1990s. I remember a student came up to me after a lecture and said, "Don't you think the reason for American greatness is because of our free enterprise system?" And I remember writing it down in note to myself, look into the history of this term. So it's kind of been a long-term interest of mine. But also, I was interested in one of my chapters is about debates about public spending. In the late 1950s, early 1960s, around the era of the Kennedy presidency, a lot of popular economic journalists, a lot of politicians talked about this was going to be the next great debate in America. We had become wealthy in the post-war boom, and the next thing we needed was a real public spending agenda because America was generating a lot of private consumption, but we also needed public consumption to match that. And one of the things I found is that debate sort of ended with a whimper, not a bang, and it ended very quickly. And there were a lot of reasons for it, including the Vietnam War and things that you know extremely well. But what I found was that the language of opposition to public spending was free enterprise, and that these terms were paired in opposition. And so I began to think about how free enterprise became sort of this catch-all term to oppose various elements of the modern liberal conception of how to promote freedom.
Well, unfortunately, Larry, we're out of time, but I do want to urge everyone to get a copy of this really fascinating book. Again, this is Larry Glickman, and the book is called Free Enterprise in American History. It's just out with Yale University Press. It's available anywhere you buy your books. As I mentioned earlier, it's getting already very good reviews, including from the Wall Street Journal, where you might not expect that, but it's been a terrific reception. As you heard from the conversation, it's a really it's a terrific read. And I also should add, which I didn't mention, Larry is a alumni of Princeton University, where we tape this podcast. So it's especially great to have you on the show.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to have a discussion with you, Julian. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. And once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Listeners, if you have any questions for us, you can email them to politicspolls@princeton.edu, or you can tweet them at us. I'm at Julian Zelizer, and you can find Sam on Twitter as well. Most important, we have a new website, which is politicspolls@princeton.edu, with tons of information, the show archives, and material for interested guests. So thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.